there was, as you may have heard, some news out of Washington last week. News about the Office of the Presidency, about the seeming erosion of political norms, about national security, fundamentally questions about America. And at the center of last week's news was a phone call between the president and Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We'll be talking for months or years about what that call meant for Americans, but we're starting today's show by taking a minute to think about what it means for the people of Ukraine. Anna Yukatenko works for the Kiev Post, but she spent the summer of 2018 in Kansas City as an international journalism fellow working here at KCUR. Maybe you remember that last Thursday our program was preempted so KCUR could carry the testimony of Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire before the House Intelligence Committee. While that was going on, Gina Kaufman went ahead with our scheduled conversation with Anna Yukatenko, and we bring it to you today.
How big a story is this for you and your colleagues in Ukraine?
Well, I would say that it's pretty big, but still, you know, it's not the biggest story because we have a lot of things that are going on in Ukraine right now. And I think this one is more for people who are following international news rather than one who are following just domestic news. I mean, it doesn't really... I would say that, this story, it mentioned one criminal case, which is still ongoing, about corruption case, which is still ongoing. And it's just one of the many cases that, you know, currently are being investigated in Ukraine and currently being sort of stolen in Ukraine. And
part of this larger network of stories revolving around corruption.
Exactly. I think this is how people sort of view it. Of course, it has some big names, like obviously everyone knows Donald Trump. But I feel that people here are more interested in what actually, you know, how would Volodymyr Zelensky behave in his further communication with Donald Trump. And, you know, some of them are really feared that Ukraine would be sort of, you know, involved in some domestic conflict in the U.S., so people don't want that to happen.
What is at stake in that conversation, the transcript that I'm sure you've read, for you as a Ukrainian reader? What do you want to know about how your president was conducting himself?
Well, I think... A lot of analysts already said that, you know, President Volodymyr Zelensky, he was kind of trying to get along with Trump, using some of his language, because obviously he wants to be in the good relationship with current administration. I think what Ukrainian readers are sort of, you know, one of the worrying parts were when Zelensky said that, yeah, I have a prosecutor general who is 100% my person. That sounded worrying. But we will see, you know, how it unfolds further.
You sent me an article that one of your colleagues wrote, and it's got some basic questions and answers for Ukrainian readers about this situation. And the central question seemed to me to be just, why is our country suddenly all over the headlines in the U.S.? From your perspective, is that a fairly unusual situation for your country's affairs to be top of mind internationally?
Well, I mean, this situation is kind of good and bad for Ukraine, because one more time, everyone, you know, it's been a while since we were in international media headlines in 2014 when we had a protest, and then the war in the eastern Ukraine, which is still continuing. It hit headlines at that time, but then, people started to forget about Ukraine. So it's sort of a good chance to remind them that we still have these problems, that we have still the conflict with Russia and Russian troops in our country. But yeah, obviously people are a little bit afraid to be involved in some kind of other country's domestic conflict.
Along the lines of just thinking about the fact that you do have Russian troops in your country, I have to assume that the withholding of funds for military protection is a huge concern for you as you read this transcript.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously that President Volodymyr Zelensky, he was, doing the best that he could to get this military assistance that Ukraine sure thing needs. And right now, since European Union started kind of, it's the conflict in the Ukraine has been going on for over 5 years now. And people started to cut off, like international leaders started to cut off some aid to Ukraine. And of course, he's fighting really hard to get as much aid as he can to Ukraine.
A talking point from members of the Republican Party who support the president, and something we heard from Devin Nunes, is that the Democrats, according to him, have turned the mainstream media into their personal spin machine. And as someone with experience doing journalism in the shadow of an autocratic regime, who also has experience working in the American news media, I wonder if you can put that in perspective.
Wow, that's a difficult one.
Yeah.
Well, I think, there were a lot of things that you, actually U.S. media, they kind of didn't know. But because, for example, taking into account the entire story with our prosecutor general, who was fired because many people, anti-corruption activists and Joe Biden, also insisted on firing him. I think for in Ukraine, this story is sort of more clear because it was obvious that that prosecutor, he had a very bad reputation. He was a prosecutor after the Euromaidan revolution, and people really wanted all of the criminal cases during that protest, 100 people killed, to be investigated, and he didn't do that so well. So I guess we just don't, we know some things that you people don't really follow in because it's domestic issues in Ukraine. About the media. Actually, I was going to say that in Ukraine, there are not so many conspiracy theories in the media. So we just, I've read a lot of far-right media saying that, raising different conspiracy theories, and even President Trump sort of mentioned one about Democratic National Committee being hacked from Ukraine. Well, this is just a conspiracy theory. Like, there is no evidence to back it up. It was Russia, according to your intelligence.
I guess what I am thinking about is just how, from one country to the other in the U.S., the way that the media, the relationship that the media has with political coverage, how does that compare to the relationship that the media has to political coverage in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's pretty much the same so far, your media are it's kind of the same right now. The situation with media in Ukraine, it's pretty good. We don't feel too much of the pressure. So people just sort of writing, investigating stuff that they should be.
Can we talk just briefly? I mean, you've addressed this a little bit, but the part of the story involving the Bidens, and especially Joe Biden, this accusation that Biden's actions in Ukraine as vice president were potentially motivated by a desire to boost his son's business dealings. You've provided a little bit of the context for how you understand that story, specifically the firing of a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. But can you explain that a little bit more and maybe share?
Sure.
If you were to start at the beginning of how you would tell the story of that prosecutor, would Biden's name come up?
Well, not really, actually. I mean, this is not for me to decide, but he was one of the people on the board of the company, which is now being investigated for unlawful enrichment. But Biden's son is actually not being investigated. Like, nobody ever mentioned his name on the documents. The person who they are investigating, it's the owner of the company, who is also former official in Ukraine. And also the former Polish president, Kwasniewski, was also on the board of this company. And like, other people. I would say, like, this case, it has been investigated in 2016 by the former prosecutor Shokin, who was then fired. And the reason why, like, Biden wasn't the only person who asked for him to be fired, because he was on many cases that people felt that they are not being investigated enough, and the cases that didn't move. And that's why, you know, not only Biden, but other anti-corruption activists were calling for his firing. And this case is still, actually right now, it's still opened in Ukraine. And other prosecutors don't really move on that case much as well. So, of course, you know, this is some corruption scheme that should be investigated. But as I said, there are many other corruption schemes and other, you know, illicit deals that Ukrainian prosecutors should be investigating right now. So for us, it's more not like one shocking scandal that hasn't been throughoutly investigated. It's just something about the broken system of justice and why these cases like that are not being investigated enough.
As a Ukrainian who spent a summer in the U.S. in the course of the Trump administration, do you find yourself answering questions there from friends and relatives trying to understand what this means to Americans?
Oh, absolutely. I think many Ukrainians, and especially my friends, they don't really get the entire thing because, you know, we had a president who was basically found guilty of treason, and he just ran away to Russia. So the entire thing for them about the US and this possible pressure is sort of very new. And of course, as I said earlier, there are lots of corruption cases, so people don't always follow each one of them. For many of them, the Burisma case, this is the name of the company, which is being investigated and where Biden's son was at the board at. This name became only familiar when this scandal broke out. So people weren't following the scandal because not because it's not important, but because there are a lot of things going on, like a lot of scandals, a lot of corruption. And sometimes they are just, you know, there is not enough time to read all of them. I mean, this case is certainly very interesting, and some of my friends, yeah, they contact me, and also we at the Kyiv Post, we filmed a video explainer about this scandal, so people who, you know, who weren't really following would cut up quickly to what's going on, so... yeah, this is what we are doing.
I know that this is not a very realistic time to expect people in the U.S. to start learning about Ukraine just for learning's sake. But once Americans reach some kind of political resolution around this incident, are there other things about Ukraine that you'd like to see us talking about at that point?
Well, obviously, the biggest one is about, you know, Russian war in Ukraine. Because it's been 5 years right now, and people are still dying, soldiers are still dying, and we are really afraid that, you know, without international attention, it's going to turn out to be some kind of gray zone, the zone of, like, never-ending conflict that no one really cares about. And I think this is what, you know, people in Ukraine are really concerned about, and they don't want this to happen. So I think, as I said, this scandal, it might be a good thing because it brings some additional attention to Ukraine. I hope that it would really help Ukraine to get more aid, because we actually we agree with Donald Trump on that one, that yeah, US and EU should give more aid to Ukraine. They should be helping out more, and they should continue their pressure on Russia, because Crimea isn't back yet, and the conflict in the eastern Ukraine is still going. So we hope people not to forget about that.
You know, would it be naive to hope that some learning about your culture beyond political conflict might occur, or is that a pipe dream?
Well, I mean, obviously Ukraine has a lot to offer in the cultural sense as well, but this is just, I think right now our priority is kind of on this political military side, kind of. Obviously, I mean, there are lots of Ukrainians in the US, and we actually have our second biggest diaspora in the US and in Canada. So, yeah, maybe this will trigger people to find out more about Ukrainian culture, including in Kansas City, because you have several people who are running Ukrainian events and Ukrainian sort of studio in the university. So,
well, Anna, it has been really good to talk to you, and I hope you'll stay in touch.
Thank you. It's been a nice talk. Thanks.
Anna Yukitenko is a journalist with the Kyiv Post. She spent the summer of 2018 as a fellow here at KCUR. Gina Kaufman spoke to her on tape last Thursday while our program was preempted as Joseph McGuire was testifying before Congress. We have to take a break, but when KCUR's Central Standard returns, how a high school teacher is using lowrider bikes to teach lessons in community, leadership, and success. Don't go away. When Eric Erazo got out of the military, he heard there were jobs in Kansas. So he picked up and moved here and got what he intended to be a temporary job with a security company. But he got assigned to security at a high school, and it changed his whole life. He saw Hispanic kids grappling with something he recognized, gangs. But he could also see what was at the heart of it, not violence, but a desperate need to belong. And so he got started setting up a different kind of community, one centered on bikes that change kids' lives. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Eric Erazo today is the coordinator of diversity and engagement for the entire Olathe Public Schools district. But that's jumping ahead too far in the story. Eric, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you here. You came to Kansas many years ago, but where did you grow up?
So I grew up actually in the Bay Area, originally born in San Francisco in the Mission District, and then moved around a little bit in the Bay Area from Hayward and different parts.
And what was that like? What was your childhood like?
You know, growing up in the Mission District, and a lot of people, you know, when they think of San Francisco, they think of the Golden Gate and things like that. But there's this inner city part, our district, specifically the Mission District, a very Hispanic-oriented area. It was awesome, but at the same time, you know, it was hard. My parents had immigrated from Guatemala, and we didn't have a lot of money. So we did a lot of walking. We didn't have, you know, vehicle. And we struggled a little bit at the beginning, and there was a lot of gangs in the community, unfortunately, at the time. So even though, you know, like I said, it was rough, it was still awesome because there's a ton of culture there.
Yeah. I mean, the gangs in the community, is that something that you found yourself flirting with?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, when I was very young, I think I was kind of falling under those statistics. You know, I'd gotten a little bit of trouble. I wasn't doing great in school. When I was 15, my then girlfriend was pregnant. At 16, I was a dad. you know, education wasn't really a priority for me, even though I always really enjoyed going to school.
So then what happened? How did you emerge from that?
Well, you know, when my daughter was born, I can remember the day that she was born and, you know, holding her in my arms. And then all of a sudden it was like real, like there's a human being that I'm responsible for. And I knew that I had to do something to change. So I started really working on getting my school together and trying to get a high school diploma, which was tough because I had gotten in trouble in school. And so I wasn't just like, hey, can I come back and finish off? So I had to find an online school. It was actually Mail back in the day.
Oh. Wow.
But I was able to work on my diploma. And when I was 18 years old, I met my beautiful wife, I'm still married to, and had my second daughter. And at that point, I decided it was probably a good idea to get out of the neighborhood. And I joined the military. And I think it just kind of shifted everything in a different direction for me.
So you went and spent some time in the military. Your eyes get opened up to the world. And somehow you end up in Kansas. How did that happen?
So after the military, so when I was in Germany, my wife got pregnant with twins. So now I'm like 22 with four kids.
Okay.
You know, we had gone to Iraq and that whole deal was going on and my time was up and I thought, you know, I really want to spend time with my kids. So came back to San Francisco. Unfortunately, it felt like time had froze. You know, I felt like I had really grown up and, you know, I had a car payment, I was paying bills and I was a dad. And then I came back and I felt like nothing had changed. So I was really frustrated and really wanted to get out of there again. I had a cousin that had been in Kansas for a long time and she said, why don't you come down here? And check it out. You know, you might find some work. So she wanted to open a restaurant, which really wasn't going to work out due to location. But while I was down here, I opened one of those home buying guides and saw how cheap the houses were here compared to where I was coming from.
Compared to the Bay Area.
Right.
Sure, yeah.
So I applied and actually went back to the city of San Francisco, and I got a call, and they said, you know, you're pre-approved. Now, this is when they were giving loans to everybody before the economy collapsed. So I came back to Kansas, and I said, you know what? In the meantime, I was looking for a job as a mechanic, which is what I was in the military. And I said, while I look for that, why don't you take me to a security company and see if they will hire me? And they did, and they sent me to Olathe North High School.
And that's how we find ourselves a step closer to where you are today. A lot of people, that would be the end of the story. They got a job working security. But something happened when you started hanging out with these kids at this school where you weren't just working security anymore.
Right. So when I got there, there was a small Hispanic population at the time, and I was seeing that there was kids that were kind of acting and talking like, you know, if they were, you know, from you know, gang related or from California. And it just didn't make sense to me because, you know, when I grew up, you know, you looked out the window and you saw, you know, terrible things, and here it was beautiful. And I'm like, you know, there has to be something else going on. So I started talking to kids, and I realized that it was, you know, if you weren't, you know, doing anything like that, you felt really small. But if you, you know, pretended to be in a gang or said you were in a gang, you know, you kind of felt a little bigger and got more attention. And I really just wanted to do something about that. So I started talking to counselors, and I would say, hey, you know, these kids are doing this stuff. You know, you should tell them, you know, this and that. And they said, well, why don't you tell them? So I started talking to kids myself. And, you know, there was one specific situation that I can remember when I was talking to a kid, and he said, well, you don't know anything about this kind of stuff. And I said, yes, I do. Let me tell you where I grew up and what I did. And, you know, it was that point that I just kind of felt like, you know what, this is your calling and this is what you have to do. So I stuck with it, and I went and used my GI Bill. I worked full time and I went to school at night, and I eventually got my bachelor's and my master's degree in education.
And along the way, you founded this group, this Hispanic Leadership Club at the school.
Correct. So what I did was try to analyze, you know, what the gangs were doing, because if you look around the country and you analyze the data, there is definitely a correlation between dropout rates and gang membership. And so I wanted to really try to understand, even for myself when I was young, you know, what did it for me? What would attract young people to go into that lifestyle? And I realized that what the gangs were doing is relationship building. You know, they talk to our kids or introduce the idea of gangs to our kids when they're at the elementary age. When they're in middle school, more responsibility. And by the time they're in high school, they're kind of in too deep to quit, or it's very hard to do so. And this is usually when, you know, a counselor will step in and talk to them. But by this time, they've been in this for a long time. So I decided to do the exact same thing. I started going to our elementary schools and talking about Hispanic Leadership Club and introducing the idea at middle school, having a club for them as well that they could fall into and have, you know, college trips and community service events. And by the time they're in high school, they're in too deep to quit. So they identify us.
So one of the things that has happened through this Hispanic Leadership Club is it evolved into a particular focus. I guess this happened in about 2016. What is the Hispanic Leadership Lowrider Bike Club?
All right. So, you know, one thing I noticed was as the club had grown, Hispanic Leadership Club, we became very academic, which was amazing. I mean, our kids were graduating, going to college, doing college fairs, doing all these amazing things. But I still had some kiddos that were kind of, you know, not participating in the club and weren't really wanting to do anything with the club. And so I thought, you know, how can I get these guys to come in and hang out with us? I knew that if I had said, hey guys, why don't you come in after school so we could just, like, you know, talk about your feelings in school, that wasn't going to probably work. But I've always been into lowriding myself. I'm actually the president of Jesus is King Christian Lowrider Car Club. And I thought, you know, what if I start building some lowrider bikes? So I got a small grant through the grant from the Olathe Public Schools Foundation and bought some bikes. And so one day I was just kind of hanging out in the school, and, you know, I had one built and the kids were asking about it. I said, hey, if you want to come in and work on these, we meet after school on Mondays. And so when the kids came over, you know, one thing that was super important was that none of us were getting paid, and we don't still. All of our mentors, nobody gets paid, including myself. This is something we do because we love it. And my mentors are actually prior Hispanic Leadership Club students, some of them are anyway, that graduated and are now going to school to be teachers.
Well, let me ask some questions about this club, but through the eyes of someone who has been part of it. Ulysses Ibarra is a graduate of the program. Ulysses, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you here. How did you first get involved in the club?
I got involved back in about 2016, 2017 with Eric. I've known Eric since I was in fourth grade. He was kind of my mentor, kind of, you know, coming into the elementary school during recess back then, and talking to me about, you know, scholarships, where to go to college, and I've been with him for ever since. When we started that club, it was just kind of, you know, building a relationship. It was kind of like a family that I've never felt before.
How did the club change what your relationships were like, you know, at school or even outside of school? What would you be doing if you weren't working on bikes?
If I wasn't working on bikes, I would probably not be going to college. Getting you know, a 12-hour, 10-hour job, you know, working long hours. But the club has changed me, you know. They've built scholarships for making me possible to go to college. And, you know, none of my family went to college, and I'll be the first one.
Wow. When did you graduate?
I graduated back in May.
Okay. And what are your college plans?
I'm studying heating and cooling, okay. Johnson County Community College.
Very cool. Well, no pun intended. Eric, how many kids have been involved in this through the years?
You know what? That's a good question. So we actively usually have around 20 to 25 members that come in on Mondays. But we reach a whole bunch more. So our club builds the bike. So the way it works is each kid gets to build this custom bike. They get to show it off at shows. They talk about it. They do all that. But they don't get to take it home until they graduate from high school. But we also made a connection with the Olathe Police Department. We actually build a lowrider bike that sits in the chief's office.
Wow.
Right now. And they give us the bikes that people don't claim that get picked up by the police department. And we refurbish those bikes and give them back to the community. But while doing that, we also take our lowrider bikes and we go to elementary schools. And we show them to the little kids, and we tell them, hey, look at these guys. You know, they look like you. They come from exactly where you're from. And here they are getting ready to go to college, and they get to build these awesome bikes. So we, you know, I'm not sure how many kids we actually get to impact, but actively we usually have around 20 in each meeting.
And it's across different age groups that you're having that impact.
Correct. So the high school kids get to come in and build the bikes, but again, we reach out to all the other ages as well.
Ulysses, what's it been like to kind of not just work on a bike that you get to keep, but actually be part of bikes for other people?
It feels pretty amazing. You know, we've had over 200 bikes donated.
Wow.
We've been working hard on them, you know, refurnish them. And we've had a lot of families reach out through churches, through different community members. And it's nice seeing little kids come in with a big smile and saying, hey, you know, when I grow up, I want to be part of this club.
So, I mean, you've been part of it. You've known Eric since you were four, but you were then part of it as like a freshman, sophomore. Now you're a graduate. What's it like to be in kind of a more mentoring role?
It feels pretty amazing because I do work a job, but I come in during volunteer time to volunteer my time with them. I get to talk to a lot of kids, see how they're doing in school. Some even kids now, they're comfortable with coming to me with problems. I step aside with them and I talk to them and tell them, hey, you know, you should do this differently. And they kind of see me as a bigger mentor. Now that I'm out of high school, you know, they thought they could never go to college, and it's just being a possibility for them to go to college.
Yeah. Help me understand, Eric, why lowrider bikes? What's the significance of lowriders for the community?
So lowriding has been part of the identity of the Chicano community or the Hispanic American community for a long, long time. Unfortunately, you know, it got a negative connotation, especially I think in the 90s with the gangster rap and things of that nature. And I've always found it intriguing that, you know, you look at a piece of metal and think it's a gang related. It can't be, right? It's art. So I really thought it was important to take that negative connotation away. And the real reason for this was that I think that when you talk about success and what success looks like, a lot of times kids, including myself growing up, you look at that and you go, that doesn't look like me. You know, I don't know anybody that looks like that. I don't know anybody that wears a suit or anybody that talks like that or drives those kind of cars. So maybe that's not for me. That's not a path that I can take. And I really wanted to show the kids is, yes, you can. You absolutely can be successful and you can absolutely do that while keeping your culture. We're just going to take that negative part away from that because that's not necessary. But we can keep the part that's, you know, art and beautiful about that culture.
Do you feel differently about your culture in any way because of your involvement in this club?
Not really. There's a lot of people that, you know, get to see me and think bad about our stereotype, and you know, we're trying to change that in a big way, make a big impact in our community. Ever since we started, people have been, you know, saying, hey, it's the Hispanic Leadership Lowrider Bike Club. You know, they're amazing. Everywhere they see us, they honk their horns when we're riding the bikes. So,
is the club open only to Hispanic students?
So actually, I'm glad you asked that. So in my prior role, I was Hispanic Student Advisor. Now I'm actually Coordinator of Diversity. So we're actually going to be changing our name to Olathe Leadership Lowrider Bike Club to be more inclusive. You know, we want to invite everybody, and we're not only a Hispanic club, but we've been under that title for a while. And actually, we have a car show coming up October 12th where we plan to announce the name change to everybody.
Right, so it's breaking news here
breaking
on Central
news
Standard.
Here. You heard it here first.
I mean, but there is significance. These are not been the easiest years for Hispanic, Latino Americans or students in particular, I have to think.
Yes, it's been very tough. I mean, you know, you just turn on the news and you can obviously see all the tension going on. And I could tell you that we've been very blessed and fortunate that in Olathe, with our amazing school district that always has had my back on all these different programs in our local police department and the relationships that we have between the Latino Coalition and different folks, you know, that we don't really feel that tension in our town. And it's been such an amazing connection with our community members. Even right now, we're actually building a lowrider police cruiser for the police department and a lowrider bike for the fire department.
That's fantastic. Ulysses, is it all boys in the club?
No. So back 2 years ago, we got our first girl. She started being involved. You know,
she was a pioneer.
Yeah. We kind of grew. So we get kids from all ages from high school. But as well, we're welcome to all the girls that want to join us as well.
I guess I'm curious, Eric, as we come close to wrapping up here. I mean, talk about the numbers here. How well is this working in terms of outcomes for the students who get involved?
So out of our initial group, right up to this point, we have 100% graduation rate, and 100% of the kids that have graduated have gone off to college, and they've all gotten some sort of a scholarship. So, you know, some of the kiddos that graduated, and Ulysses remembers, you know, they weren't doing very good in school. You know, sometimes, you know, they might not even go to class and then come to the club. But, you know, having that relationship building with amazing mentors that could just sit there and chat with them and let them know, like, this is absolutely absolutely a possibility and we got your back has really transformed these kiddos. So we definitely see it as a worthwhile thing to do. And I love Mondays, which not a lot of people get to say, but that's when we meet after school.
And it's had an impact on you too. I mean, now you've been promoted up through the ranks. You're the coordinator of diversity and engagement for the whole district.
Right. It definitely has. I mean, like I said, you know, I can remember that day vividly when I felt like this is my calling. This is what I have to do. And I stuck with it. And, you know, it's been an amazing experience. And I just had a whole lot of people that believed in me and just got to work in an amazing place.
That's Eric Erazo, coordinator of diversity and engagement. Also have been joined by Ulysses Ibarra, both of them part of the Hispanic Leadership Lowrider Bike Club. Thanks, both of you. This is a great story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next up, a journey around the country through the eyes of a man who traveled to all 50 states to learn about America and 6 weeks ago fell in love with Kansas City. We'll meet him when KCUR Central Standard returns. I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors and her ample rivers, and it was not there. In her fertile fields and boundless forests, and it was not there. In her democratic Congress and her matchless Constitution, and it was not there. Those are the words of Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who in 1831 traveled all over the United States and wrote the book Democracy in America. Ultimately, he found what this country was really about was its people. He wrote, "America is great because she is good, and if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great." This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Road trips across America obviously are not new, but they never cease to bring revelations. My next guest is Ryan Bernstein, who just moved to Kansas City after his own long trip, visiting way more states than Tocqueville, probably sleeping on more couches too. Ryan Bernstein, welcome to Kansas City and to Central Standard.
I love being here. Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
It's really great to have you. So how did this trip to all 50 states come about?
So I was studying over at Oxford in England. So you can imagine what a slap in the face it is to the Brits when I decide to study American democracy. As
you
opposed
came
to,
here. Why do you want to go back there?
So basically, I had this project lined up. And originally, I was going to write a book about the 2020 election because I'd worked in 2016 presidential politics. And the timing just didn't work out with the 5 months that we were given off to go study. So I pitched this project to my department. I said, I think I'm going to go to all 50 states, and I hope that they'd sort of help me whittle it down to something more manageable. And they didn't. They said, you know what? That sounds great. Go study American democracy by going to all 50 states. And I was like, wait, what? I actually have to do this now? I don't even have a car. So I kind of had to take a leap of faith and hope that the goodness of the American people would rise to help me do this incredible, difficult feat.
Yeah. So what were the logistics of this? You had to get a car, I guess.
Yeah. Gosh, that was the thing that was like the real afterthought. Oh, I have to drive everywhere. It's amazing. For as polarizing as social media can be, it also was my best friend on this trip. I posted a Facebook status about this crazy trip saying, help, I have to find a way to pay for all this. I have to find a way to go all these places. And I got over 300 people coming to me and saying, hey, you can stay on my couch, you can stay in my daughter's bedroom, you can stay in my garage, you can stay in our guest house. And that happened all over the country. And starting off like that, as opposed to getting a corporate sponsorship from Nabisco and passing out Cheez-Its in all 50 states, right, was a really good way to sort of feel that Alexis de Tocqueville vibe of, you know, the American people are really good and generous if you give them the opportunity to be. So I got really lucky, and this trip was all because of the generosity of people in America.
And you didn't set out just to touch the ground of all 50 states. You actually wanted to spend time in each one and in different parts of each one.
Exactly. So every place I went, I tried to do a biggish city, which in some states is easier to find than others, mm-hmm. A medium-sized town, and a small village. And the best part about the trip was, in staying with people, people could recommend the real thing to do. It wasn't like I was staying in a hotel and going to the concierge and saying, oh, where's the best place to get barbecue? In which case, they would have told me Joe's here.
We know where you stand.
Yeah, that's where I stand. Sorry if I'm turning off any listeners. But the thing about staying with people is they could say, you know, someone's doing something amazing in this community. You need to meet this person. And once you meet that person, they say, you know what, there's someone else you should talk to. We want to show you the best of our community. And that was the amazing thing that happened. It's just one thing would lead to another, and I'd meet like-minded people doing things I never could have imagined in places that I never thought I would visit.
How long did it take?
It took about 5 months. I started in October of 2018, and I saw some things on the ground. I was there for the midterm elections, the government shutdown. So there were some really big kind of consequential events happening. And it was interesting because the journey was really about discovering American democracy again and discovering the way people feel about their own communities. But having the background of these big, quite drastic national issues really made some interesting dinner conversations.
You had spent some time thinking about American democracy in a different way as part of a campaign before this, right?
Exactly. And that's sort of, so I'm currently writing a book about this experience. And the opening chapter is about a campaign rally gone wrong. And I don't want to spoil too much or say where I land, but I was working on a campaign where basically they had a event space that was only available for 800 people, and they invited thousands and thousands and thousands of people to this event, knowing that only a certain amount would get in, but they wanted to show the optics of really long lines outside of that event. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's not what American democracy is about. It's about empowering people. It's about making people feel that they're heard, that their communities are valued, and about making people feel a part of this thing that technically we all own, as opposed to playing to a big national media circus or playing into optics. So that was the sort of impetus for the trip. And then when I read Democracy in America, I realized that Alexis de Tocqueville was 26 years old, which was the same age that I was at the time, and said, you know what, if this French dude can do it, this American dude can do it.
And so there you were. He emerges with this sort of sense of the optimistic spirit of Americans, 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. Did you think that's what you were going to find as well?
No, and everyone seems very surprised when I say that I feel more optimistic than ever, because they say, look at what's going on with our national government. Look at what's going on with how polarized we are. I've seen countless examples of people coming together around local issues in their community and reaching out to people of different, you know, classes, religions, parties even, to get things done in the arena that you know how to get something done, and that's your community. And that's why the big takeaway for me is our communities are so strong, and when we invest in those communities and we look inwards at what we can actually accomplish in our own neighborhoods or our own towns and, you know, our own school systems, we can do a lot. And that's why the big takeaway from the trip is not only just getting the pulse of America, but what we can do to live a fulfilled life. And I think a lot of people are anxious or they feel alienated. And I think one of the causes is the fact that we have sort of fallen away from volunteering, showing up at our PTAs, engaging with our neighbors. And I think social media is a factor of that. But I also think it's the fact that national politics is so divisive that we don't realize that we actually agree on a lot more than we think we do, especially when we're talking about the issues in our own neighborhood at home.
So you're telling the story of this trip in a bunch of ways. You're working on a book, you mentioned, but you're also you also have a podcast called 50 States of Mind, where you're taking an episode, I think, for each state that you visited.
Yeah.
You've only just begun, but so far, what have been some of the favorite stories you've had to tell?
Well, what's been really fun for me is I've been able to trick listeners who want to learn about America into learning about other places as well. So I got done with the trip. I went back to Oxford, and I was in this really amazing cohort of people from all over the world, 7 continents. We're talking people who have lived in Antarctica, Pakistan, Mexico, Jamaica. And being able to sit down with those people and play interviews with a small town mayor in Ohio, or play an interview with a former convicted felon, and having their preconceived notions of different states in America challenged, and allowing them to also tell their own stories about, you know, what are the effects of the war on terror on Pakistan? How does that affect perceptions of America over there? And what about what I'm playing changes the way you think about America? And so it's this really interesting dialogue that I'd never really heard facilitated, and you just realize how many preconceived notions that we all have and how many examples there are to counteract those.
Why did you call the podcast 50 States of Mind rather than 50 States?
50 States of Mind. Well, I think one of the big takeaways is that when you try to standardize something with maybe a national campaign or try to boil things down to issues that sort of apply to everyone, it's sort of insulting to the people who live in very different regions. I mean, if someone who grew up in even the northern part of California, which is very rural and agricultural, is going to have a different state of mind than someone who lives in the mid part of California would have. It's more urban and industrial. So I think we all have such different states of mind based on where we're from. I'm from the industrial Midwest. I'm from Rockford, Illinois originally. And I moved to New York City, and living among people who had lived in New York City their whole lives, I realized a lot of people didn't understand what it meant to be from the Midwest and to have suffered through the 2008 recession. And there's a state of mind that comes from where you grow up. And I think paying homage to that we all have a diverse range of perspectives, but that makes us stronger, is something that I wanted to pay homage to in the title.
Well, and speaking of the Midwest, I mean, you visited 50 states. You got a glimpse of everywhere in the whole country. And yet, you have chosen, at the end of this journey, to live in Kansas City, Missouri. How come?
So it's actually a bit, sounds too perfect. So I'd gone to 48 states, and Missouri was my 49th state, and I was so tired. Mm. I had been with people all the time. I was just sort of ready to be done, and I was sort of disappointed that I hadn't fallen in love with the place. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll move to Madison, maybe I'll move back to Rockford, maybe Minneapolis. And then I came to Kansas City, and I was staying in the suburbs with this really nice family that I know originally from Rockford. And they took me to Q39, also a great barbecue place. And then they said, do you want us to drive you around the city? So they drove me around the city for about 3 hours, and they drove me to the River Market. They took me to Betty Ray's, and we finished up downtown and finally at the World War I Memorial. And I remember I was looking out over this incredible lit up skyline after they had told me just about what an amazing community it is, how many local endeavors there are, both in the arts and also in restaurants and bars. And I just kind of said, is there anything wrong with this place? Is there anything that isn't great? And they said, no, everywhere else I'd been, all other 150 places, there was always one thing that was wrong, and there was one thing that they wished they had. And Kansas City just seemed perfect, and I wanted to be a part of it. And it made no sense. I mean, I really don't know anyone here. I don't have a lot of connections. And, you know, you realize when you go to New York and you go with your entire college class that those connections get you jobs, and they help you get where you want to go. And I kind of followed my heart on that. I just went back to school in England, and I was thinking about Kansas City nonstop. It was like going on a great first date and wanting to go on another one, just thinking about that person over and over and over. And I started making plans and found out my best friend from high school was moving here and said, you know what, I guess the signs are pointing to Kansas City. And I just moved here. It was another leap of faith, really.
So what do you want to do from here? I mean, you mentioned your relative youthfulness as you've undertaken this. You've done a big project. What do you want to be when you grow up, so to speak?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, right now I'm here finishing the book. And in the meantime, I'm trying to get involved in different community organizations. So I'm just starting with Big Brothers Big Sisters here in Kansas City, volunteering at the YMCA. And I really want to meet people and get to know the city first and kind of pay it forward. But, you know, everyone has to make a living. I've been up for a few job interviews, teaching mostly. I'm currently a sub at one of the schools here locally.
All right.
But I think something with teaching feels really in my wheelhouse. But these things that I've learned on the trip, I want to keep sharing with people and hopefully finding a way to take that. And
obviously it's not true that there are no problems here, that it's, you know, it isn't perfect here.
Right.
How do you think this work that you've done is of benefit to people in Missouri or Kansas or anywhere else who look around and say, it's not so perfect, it's not so great?
Exactly. And I know every place has problems. And I think that's part of the thing that I'm excited about, because every place can come together and find solutions to these problems. I knew that Kansas City wasn't perfect, and it has a lot of things that aren't right, but it was perfect for me. And it reminded me of Rockford in a lot of ways, because Rockford is really up and coming right now, even though it was listed on the third most miserable city in America on Forbes list. But I think learning to get people together in a room and get different perspectives together to have a discussion, you always come to something that's better than you would have had if you were just sort of listening to one side or going forward with one plan. And I think facilitating conversations and talking to people of all different backgrounds, all different classes, all different ethnicities, I think that's where the solutions come from. And that's what I've been able to learn on this crazy 50 states of mind journey.
That's Ryan Bernstein. He's an Oxford grad and now a Kansas City resident. You can find 50 States of Mind wherever you find your podcasts. Ryan, thanks for taking a few minutes with us.
Thank you so much, Brian.
That's all the time we have today. You can catch anything you missed at kcur.org. We'll post the audio of this show a little later today. Gina Kaufman will be back tomorrow, and the show sounds like it'll be pretty cheesy. Literally, we're talking about American cheese and whether it defies the bad rap it may have. There's more, too, so don't miss it. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao with Anne Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date.